Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real-life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at ritaschulte.com. That's S-C-H-U-L-T-E.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. Jesus Christ was arguably the most influential figure in history. The effects of his life and ministry have been unprecedented. In his new book, Who is This Man?, John Ortberg takes a look at the 2,000-year history outlining Christ's impact on the world. John is the pastor of Menlo Park Presbyterian Church. He's the best-selling author of When the Game is Over, It All Goes Back in the Box, The Life You've Always Wanted, and If You Want to Walk on Water, You Have to Get Out of the Boat. You can find him at johnortberg.com. John, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be on, Rita.
In your new book, Who is This Man?, you cover over 2,000 years of history outlining Jesus' impact on the world. What inspired you to write about this?
It was a funny thing. It actually grew out of a talk that I did one time where I had been speaking with some folks, and they were outside of the church and had lots of questions about Jesus. And that conversation grew into a message that I would do at the church where I thought, for all that we talk about Jesus, even people inside the church a lot of times have no idea the extent to which the world in which we live, our history, and our culture have been transformed by Jesus. And so I'd like to do a message where I just kind of machine gun a bunch of that stuff out there. And so I did, and I've never had a response to a talk like that. It was, you know, we got to the end of that talk, and, you know, it was a lot of information to put folks through, and, you know, no jokes or, you know, other pieces to that often are part of talks, and people's response afterward was this sense of wonder and marvel, and I never knew, I am so proud to be connected to this man, Jesus. So it was really kind of out of that experience that I thought, man, I would love to be able to write and simply help people understand the extent to which we live in a Jesus-impacted world.
That's super cool. I love the name of the book because it gives us such an important question to answer, because how we answer that question, who is this man,
yep,
will really determine everything else in our lives, won't it?
Well, you know, it's a remarkable thing. I actually, this last weekend at our church, just did a whole message in response to another book, a book called Zealot by a guy named Reza Aslan. And that's a book that also raises the question of what was the identity and mission of Jesus. And remarkably enough, you know, that book has hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list.
Really?
It's quite controversial. It comes to a real different point of view in some real important respects. But just the fact that 2,000 years later, on the other side of the world, the number one best-selling book is a book that just raises questions about what was the identity of this crucified carpenter in Nazareth. You know, it's a staggering reality that one person should have this kind of impact on world history.
Yeah, he's the man that won't go away, isn't he?
Yeah.
Why?
No, you know, year after year, decade after decade, country after country, century after century, it's kind of like if you're in a boat and there is this wake that just absolutely rocks you, you've got to ask the question, what must have been the size of the ship to cause a wake like that? And there just has never been a wake produced like the wake produced by Jesus.
Okay, so you suggest that his influence couldn't have been happenstance. Give us some support. Give us some evidence for your theory.
You know, One of the things that I try to do in the book is to say, let's bracket for a moment, set aside whether or not folks believe in God, whether or not people believe that Jesus was divine, all those kind of questions, and just consider the impact of this one life on history. And then we walk through so many areas, like when it comes to compassion. In the ancient world, people would often care for folks in their family or their tribe, but the notion that those who suffer, those who were deformed, those who were the wrong gender should be cared for simply did not exist in the ancient world outside of this little people of Israel. And then through Jesus, over time, that notion that the least of these, those who are poor, those who are sickly, those who are deformed, have a merit on human compassion. That came to the world through Jesus, the notion that every human being is of equal worth. Now, we live in a world where we kind of take that for granted, but in the ancient world, they did not believe that. You know, Attila the Hun did not believe that. That came to the world through Jesus. Universal education, you know, that notion that everybody ought to be literate. In the ancient world, people have always loved to learn, but education was reserved for wealthy elite families. But there was this unusual little community called the church, and they remembered that the man that they followed used to teach everybody. And so they began to teach everybody, male, female, slave, free. And over time, like in the Protestant Reformation, came the idea that everybody ought to be able to read the Bible for themselves. And out of that came this dream of universal literacy. The first universities that were begun in history, beginning with University of Paris and then Oxford and Cambridge.
Right, our universities.
In our own country, Harvard, Yale. Mm-hmm. These were all begun by followers of Jesus.
Absolutely. And most people don't even know that anymore because Yale, Harvard, those places seem to be so liberal now.
The motto of Oxford University is "The Lord is my light." And if anybody goes through, you know, the original Harvard handbook, it's quite clear that they were, you know, when they first began, it was to help people to follow Jesus, and in particular, to help educate people who were going to go into the ministry of the church. And actually, the first act that mandated universal public education in the U.S. and required folks to contribute to it, it was in Massachusetts, and it was called the Old Deluder Satan Act, which is a snappy piece of, a snappy title for a piece of legislation, because they said in this act that it is the evil one that prefers that people be kept in darkness and ignorant, and that God wants our minds to be enlightened and to read. And I think in a day when the value of public education and, sadly, sometimes even Christian commitment to supporting, to our tax dollars, public education can be on the wane, it's really interesting that the beginning of that whole thing in our own country was championed by followers of Jesus.
Yeah. We don't think about these things anymore. You talk in the book about how the American Revolution connected civil governments to the principles of Christianity. Why is it important for us to remember all this stuff, John?
A whole bunch of reasons, Rita. Partly is just simply to be aware of the reality of history, because in our day, often we're not. And if we're not aware of what shaped our history, we're not in a good position to learn from it. But in particular, my desire was, because folks so quickly tend to go to either I'm a believer or I'm not, and sometimes even in churches, our approach with people can run along the lines of you have to believe the right things about Jesus' divinity, and either you do or you don't. And with Jesus himself, he didn't start by saying to his disciples, affirm my divinity and then you can follow me. He simply started by saying, listen to me and understand what I have to say about how life works and how forgiveness works and how humility works and how love works. And try it and see if it does not actually prove to be true and lead you into the way of living life. And as people did that, and they learned his message, and they followed his way, they came over time to realize no mere human being could do this. But they didn't start with that belief. They actually started by coming to look at and understand Jesus' teaching in his life, and that led to confidence in his identity and his divine mission.
Hmm.
I think, Rita, a lot of times, even in the church in our day, our problem is we don't start there. We try to start with, you have to believe this certain stuff. And occasionally people do, but I think the best way to start with people is start on common ground and say, let's just take Jesus as a person and look at his message and see his impact. And if you do that and you follow it sincerely and honestly, it will lead you to understanding his true identity and mission.
Hmm. Yeah, you talked a little while ago about the whole idea of Jesus and this idea of compassion and how that wasn't really prevalent in the ancient world. The other thing I'm thinking about, and you just mentioned, is this idea of forgiveness. I think one of the hardest things we wrestle with, as whether we're believers or non-believers, is that what Jesus taught about forgiving those who have profoundly wounded us. Talk a little bit about that. That's a huge piece for people today in terms of, you know, what Jesus taught about that.
Well, it's tremendously challenging personally, and you know, everybody listening to us is going to be thinking about, and for some folks in very deep, profound ways, because they have been abused, they have been betrayed, they have been, you know, horribly wounded. For others, those cuts might not be as dramatic, but we all wrestle with this. What most people don't understand is that notion of the value of forgiveness, the importance of forgiveness, and loving and blessing enemies, is another one of those ideas that was not widely shared in the ancient world. In ancient Rome, generally, the notion was that you ought to help your friends, but you should hurt your enemies. In fact, there's a monograph that one historian wrote about that in ancient Rome. It's just called Helping Friends, Hurting Enemies. I was years ago in England, there's a place called Bath in England that is the site of a Roman ruin, and people used to go there and write out prayers to the Roman gods, and most of them are called curse tablets, because most of them are prayers for the gods to curse my enemies. Somebody cheated me in business, somebody stole my wife, and I want the gods to curse them. There are no bless your enemy tablets in that ruin. It was Jesus who brought to the broader world this notion that love of the enemy and forgiveness are virtues that ought to be practiced. A Princeton scholar named Hannah Arendt, who herself was not a believer, said that this was so dramatically true that the discoverer of forgiveness in the role of humanity is Jesus of Nazareth.
Mm. Wow. Why did his movement succeed where so many others have failed, even the Roman Empire?
You know, the general idea in this world is if you can accumulate enough power and be successful enough, then you will be able to prevail. And even in our day, a lot of political struggles are just around, we'll think, if we can just get the right legislation passed, if we can just get the right amount of power accumulated, then we'll carry the day. The reality is that for a movement to truly pervasively change the world, it has to capture the hearts of women and men. And I think ultimately, there simply is no one who has ever addressed the great questions that face human beings. What is real? What is a good person like? How do you become a good person? Nobody has ever addressed them with the power, simplicity, or truth that Jesus has. And over time, that's what prevailed. And then in the early days of the church, there was this little community. And it's not just that they were able to win arguments with people about faith. They actually cared for the poor. They actually risked their lives to help the sick, when other folks would have nothing to do with that. They actually created a community where slave and free, Gentile and Jew, male and female became like family. And the quality of that community, its joy, its generosity, its ability to transform human lives, its experience of the transcendent reality of God was so strong that the world had never seen anything like it, and it just simply changed the world.
Yeah, absolutely it did. You have a chapter titled, What Does a Woman Want? And you talk about how radical Jesus' view of women was for his day and time, and he took them seriously. And you suggest this led to women taking prominent roles of leadership in the early church. What do you think the message for us as women today is?
Man, I think in our day, so often folks just have a general illusion that religion is placing women in a secondary role. And again, if folks understand what life was like in the ancient world, like in ancient Rome, widows were actually fined, essentially taxed, if they survived their husbands, because they were considered a drag on the economy. A guy named Rodney Stark writes that in the ancient world, there were about 1.3 or 1.4 million males for every 1 million females.
Wow.
And if you ask what happened to the other 300 or 400,000 females, the answer is they were left to die of exposure at birth because they were the wrong gender. And this was a quite common practice, and it wasn't considered embarrassing or something to be ashamed of. And it was actually written into laws in the Roman Empire and in other parts of the ancient world. And it was really in the church where people began to remember they followed this man who would say, let the little children come to me, whether they were male or female. For Jesus, the longest conversation he is recorded as having is with a woman at the well. She was a Samaritan woman, and the text actually says that his disciples were quite surprised to find the rabbi talking all alone with a woman. There were women who traveled together with Jesus and the disciples in ways that would have been quite scandalous in that day. And if you look at the end of, for example, Paul's epistles, at the names that were listed there, you see the number of women who played a prominent role in the early church is quite staggering. And I think part of what that says in our day is, for anybody, when you actually look at the Bible from beginning to end in its full context, that women as well as men shared the image of God, were the recipients of Jesus' grace, death, and resurrection, were the witnesses to the resurrection, were pillars in the early church. In Christ, there is no more male or female. That women ought to serve with whatever gifts they have, leading, teaching, mercy, administrating, evangelizing, as the Spirit gifts them. And the world needs that, and the church needs that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. You also talk about Jesus' transformation of the essence of marriage.
Again, in the ancient world, marriage was thought about quite differently than it is in our world. And in ancient Rome, for example, the notion of the double standard, which continues to exist in our day, but often informally and often in a way that we're kind of ashamed or embarrassed about, that was actually written into the law in Rome. So, for example, if a husband had sex outside of his marriage, as a general rule, that was not a problem. If a husband had sex with the wife of another man, that was adultery, but it wasn't, the reason that it was is the wife was actually considered the property of the other man. So it was actually a crime against the man, and it was a property violation.
Okay.
And part of what Jesus brought was this teaching that goes all the way back to the Old Testament. Of God's intent for marriage. And it took a considerable amount of time for that to work itself out. But over time, that notion of a marriage as a covenant of a husband and a wife, you know, prevailed in a way that was very different than what marriage looked like in ancient Greece or ancient Rome.
Yeah, the woman got stoned, didn't she?
Well, again, depending on where it would happen, but yeah. Very often, particularly in Israel, yeah, absolutely.
Wow. You describe Jesus as a dangerous man in the book. What makes him so?
In his own country, you know, we'll often think about Jesus as this kind of meek and mild, you know, like to hang out with little children, kind of guru shepherd figure. But people like that don't get crucified.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at certain of Jesus' acts, for example, when he goes into the temple and he's got whips and he overthrows the money changers, he's very seriously threatening systems out of which people are exploiting the poor, for example, are misrepresenting God, are keeping people away from God. And anytime Jesus comes onto the scene, that's all going to get challenged. And anytime anybody challenges power and the way things are, or money and the way things are, they're a dangerous person and they're in a dangerous place.
Yeah, I love
and,
that.
And Jesus did that, and he did it with great fearlessness and great courage, and they got him into enormous trouble. And he didn't do it, you know, simply because he had a desire to be regarded as a dangerous person. He did it out of love. And love will always put itself in danger, and love is a dangerous thing, far more dangerous ultimately than anger.
Yeah, I think oftentimes people see Jesus as this loving, quiet, mild, meek man, but
yep.
He did challenge systems, and I think that's what's super cool. I love how you said that.
Yeah, I think there's no other way to understand how did he end up on a cross.
He was definitely a threat. So was he a revolutionary figure?
Boy, that's part of what the Zealot, quite recent book, The Zealot by Reza Aslan, gets into. And the answer is, on the one hand, yep, Jesus was a revolutionary figure. He was a revolutionary figure in ways that had definite implications for economic and political realities in his day. The poor were being oppressed in Israel, very heavy taxes, supported by the Roman government. That was not okay. However, Jesus was not a revolutionary figure in the sense that he was one more human being who believed that physical coercive political power was the ultimate solution to the human problem. And that's why he said things like, "My kingdom is not of this world." What he believed and taught was that now through him, what he called the kingdom of God, and that simply is God's presence, God's favor, God's power, has become available here on earth. And anybody who wants to can step right in it and live it. Anybody who's listening to us right now can love God, can know God, can be empowered by God, can be guided by God, can be forgiven by God, and that is the ultimate reality, that it is eternal reality, that all merely human systems and claims will be judged by it, and that's the ultimate revolution. But it's far beyond a merely human political revolution.
Mm. Well, I think Jesus had passion. That's what I love about Jesus. He was passionate. Do you think that's why he lit a fire in the hearts of those who followed him?
You know, the story of Jesus, we don't tend to use this phrase quite so much now as folks used to, but the story, particularly of his crucifixion, is called the Passion Narrative.
Yeah.
And that's because his whole life, and ultimately supremely the cross, which stands at the center of human history, is an expression of the passion of God. And that's the desire of God's heart for wrong to be righted, for justice to be done, for humanity to be redeemed. It's a hatred of everything that stands in the way of that, and a love for human beings that cannot be extinguished. And it is the greatest passion on earth. And, of course, human passions often get junked up and can lead us into trouble. But there's a reason why we're so moved by passion. And that is because passion is what lies at the heart of God, and it lie at the heart of Jesus.
Beautiful. Yes. What one thing amazes you about Jesus? After all this research for this book, after all the books you've written, what one thing amazes you about Jesus?
Well, again, if I step back and just consider him as a person, so I'm just taking the position of the average observer of Jesus, I think maybe the most staggering fact is this. When Jesus died on the cross, he looked like an absolute failure. One of the things I talk about in the book is, with most people that have a big impact on history, most people that are regarded as great men or great women, when they die, everybody knows this is an impact that's going to go on. So Albert Einstein, Napoleon, Steve Jobs, any folks like that, when they die, people recognize, you know, it's going to be a huge imprint. When Jesus died on the cross, very few people knew his name. He had a tiny handful of followers, and they all believed that his death meant that he was not the Messiah, and it was over. So if you were going to give an award to, it's an odd category, but like the least likely to posthumously succeed,
yeah,
it would be Jesus.
Right.
And it's the gap. It's not just the size of the impact that he's had on human history. It's the gap between how obscure and failed he appeared to be on the day he died, and then his easily unmatched, unprecedented, unrivaled impact on human history. It's not just that impact. It's the size of the gap between how big the impact is and how finished his cause looked on the day that he died. And, of course, part of why I think that is so significant is I just don't think there's any way to get to the emergence of the church and this Jesus movement apart from the resurrection. And that changes everything.
Sure. And what tremendous hope it is for us, especially when we feel undone and like failures and, you know, oh, my story's ended, I'm done. You know, the story isn't finished yet because the story Jesus is telling is one of redemption.
My friend Dallas Willard, who just passed away this spring,
I know.
Said it's real important for you to understand this about your identity. You are an unceasing spiritual being with an eternal destiny in God's great universe.
Mm. That's beautiful.
And that is how Jesus helped us understand the human condition and each of our identity.
What's the one or two takeaways that you want people to have from the book, John?
There's one, and it's real simple. Very early on in the Gospel of Matthew, or in the Gospel of John, when Jesus is beginning his ministry, and he's doing and saying these remarkable things, and people just didn't have a category for it, and some people were skeptical, and some people loved him, and some people doubted, and there was a guy named Nathaniel, and he was kind of one of the skeptics, and he wasn't sure, and a friend was talking to him, and the friend's comment was just, come and see. That's the takeaway from the book. Just take a next step towards him. Maybe right now you're filled with doubts. That's okay. You could be an admirer. That's a real good place to start.
John, thank you so much for being our guest today. It was wonderful. This is an important work. I know it will stir the hearts and the curiosity of many. Just God bless you for your ministry and all that you're doing for the kingdom.
Thank you very much, Rita, and God bless you as well.
I had a big hole in my heart, and I was looking. I was looking everywhere.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at ritaschulte.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.